Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast, where we explore cutting-edge strategies to keep teams human-centered, drive innovation, and empower you with the tools and insights needed to help your team excel and thrive in today's world. Your host is Dane Gernebelt, a seasoned expert with over 20 years of experience enhancing team dynamics and innovation. When pressure goes unmanaged, it doesn't just make work harder, it erodes trust, clarity, and connection. In this episode, Dane is joined by Sabina Nawaz. Sabina is an elite executive coach who advises C-level executives and teams at Fortune 500 corporations, government agencies, nonprofits, and academic institutions around the world. She's the author of the book, You're the Boss, Become the Manager You Want to Be and Others Need. Together, they unpack why pressure, not power, corrupts leaders and how to break free from its grip. They'll explore Sabina's multiple meanings exercise, a simple yet transformative way to challenge assumptions and unlock fresh perspectives. And before they wrap, Sabina shares how to deliver feedback that lands, turning uncomfortable conversations into moments of real growth. If you've ever found yourself leading under stress, defaulting to a single narrative, or struggling to give feedback that strengthens rather than strains our relationships, this conversation is one to take to heart. So, teamwork makes the dream work, and we're here to inspire your next collaborative breakthrough. Gather your team or put on your headphones, and let's dive in together.
Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast. My name's Dane Gernebelt, CEO of the Huddle 3 Group. And today I'm joined from Vancouver, Canada by Sabina Nawaz. Sabina is an author of You're the Boss, a new book out in just March of this year, and also a CEO coach. So I'm excited to dive right in. Welcome, Sabina.
Thank you. Thank you, Dane.
So tell us a little bit more about you. How did you come to be coaching CEOs and writing this book?
There's so many directions I can take that story in, and we can talk the entire show about that. Let me just start by saying that I was at one point a lousy manager at Microsoft. Uh-huh. It wasn't always the case. When I first started managing, I managed teams that built software, and most of the people on my team would say, "You're the best boss I've ever had." I cared about them. I coached them. Those were great years. And then everything changed. I was running Microsoft's management development. Mm. This was the first day as I was getting ready to come back from parental leave with my first child. And as I'm putting on lipstick for the first time in 5 months, my assistant Lori calls me frantic. "Where are you? Steve expects you in 30 minutes. Lori starts reading me this memo I'm supposed to discuss with Steve Ballmer, the CEO of the company.
Oh my gosh.
Yes, exactly. While I hit warp speed on my way to work. And that set the pace and tone for work. Infant at home, inbox overflowing, calendar packed, no sleep, no peace, no patience. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
I'm sure people have been there. And overnight, I morphed from being caring and compassionate to snippy and short. Mm. Short-tempered, rushing to meet deadlines. I have no time to provide detailed explanations, let alone repeat them. Grow up, pay attention, do the job. Told myself there'll be time for empathy later, but of course there never is. And I started to micromanage. When people would come to my office, I would leave all 10 fingers on the keyboard and look over my shoulder, indicating I'm very busy. You're less important than me. Move on. Mm-hmm. Spit it out. And the worst part is, I thought I was being efficient.
Mm.
Until my colleague Joe stops by. And Joe says, "Zach is crying in his office because of what you said."
Bang.
And my whole body flushes with shame. And I think, how did I morph from being caring and nurturing to this? Somebody people are apparently afraid of and really don't like. And that's why I've written this book.
Excellent.
Because I have so much compassion for managers who are under a lot of pressure. I believe that it is not power that corrupts, it's pressure that corrupts. And then power isolates you from the impact of your actions under pressure that can turn best boss ever to boss from hell without you even realizing it. So when pressure is unmanaged, it can convert those good intentions, because who wakes up in the morning saying, "Let's make life miserable for everybody?"
Yeah.
It can convert those good intentions into destructive habits. Just like for me, it didn't just squeeze my time. Pressure also squeezed out my humanity.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a fantastic, it's a tough origin story, but it's remarkably clear the way that you experienced it and have shifted into this new body of work.
Yeah.
So thank you. The pressure and power elements, I'd not heard that before, but it makes a lot of sense. So the pressure corrupts, it's not the power. A lot of people will say power corrupts.
Right.
But where in your research and experience did you find that pressure was corrupting, you know, leaders, middle managers, you know, more wholesale?
Mm-hmm. Well, in addition to my own experience, I mean, just if you're listening to this podcast right now, think about what kinds of pressure you're under and how much pressure you're under.
Yeah.
And then think about, under pressure, have you ever done something that you're not proud of? And the answer is yes.
Yeah.
Well, all of us. And so if that's what I mean by pressure corrupts.
Yeah.
The problem is when you're a boss, everything already gets amplified. So you raise your voice a little bit, you provide a little bit of a harsher criticism than necessary, and it becomes monumental in its impact.
Yes.
And that's because power is like this broken volume knob. It's distorted. Everything coming up is milder, cushioned in praise, and everything going down is amplified. More dire, more urgent, gunning directly for me. So a boss is frowning in a meeting, and I'm thinking, I'm toast. I'm fired.
Yeah.
So when we don't mindfully navigate pressure and those things show up, those behaviors show up, it has a really, really way magnified impact on our teams.
Yeah.
And research shows that when bosses treat employees poorly or when employees believe the bosses are treating them poorly, they not just play video games, they deliberately make mistakes.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is super damaging. But also, I believe, and I can't quote the research, that it also heavily impacts the mental health of the employee, which then cascades to family members at home and community members, whether it's in a sports club or whatever they're doing. So it has a huge multiplier effect in the negative.
Yes, it even has impact on physical health.
Yep.
There's data on the additional incidences of heart disease based on the stresses from a bad boss.
Yeah. Yeah, it's I think it's interesting. I know the Surgeon General here in the US has talked a lot about like the loneliness epidemic.
Yes.
I then saw some data saying that parenting is becoming a health problem.
Really?
I think 2 in 5 parents are suffering a lot of pressure and fatigue. And I like the way that you said it earlier here, no sleep, no peace, no patience. I think that's true for a lot of parents right now.
Well, yes. And I wonder if there's an overlay between the loneliness epidemic and the stresses of parenting, where you no longer, in many cases, have that community of support, that village it takes to raise a child, is not existent in many cities.
I think you're right. And then I would add to that in a true Venn diagram, your piece, which is the bad boss. So if you've got the loneliness epidemic, you don't have the community, you're parenting and you have a bad boss, you are in the pressure cooker.
You're toast.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But it is really fascinating that is true in so many parts of our communities. And yet it's not a problem that we're really solving. So I'd love to understand from like the way you approach the book, what is it that you bring to the reader in the book that allows them to become the manager that they want to be, to, you know, to be that person, to be that manager for others as well?
Mm-hmm. Dane, the book is around this framework of managing pressure and power. We're never going to be pressure free. That's a fantasy.
Yeah.
So how can we make ourselves pressure-proof? And similarly with power, how can we become powerful? There's a lot of good things about pressure and power. You know, pressure turns coal into diamonds. So it doesn't have to define you.
Yes.
It can refine you, but how do you do that? So based on my research, which is about 12,000 pages of data, there are these very common pressure pitfalls that we fall into and these very common power gaps that we create. Gaps as in the distance between people once we have a title, a position, an authority that makes it hard to see things clearly. one of the most common pressure pitfalls is that of what's called the sole provider. Sole as in S-O-L-E, the belief that I'm the only one who can. And, you know, it often starts with a noble or a noble sounding narrative.
Yes.
So you've got the caretaker sole provider who says, well, you know, this is an especially busy time of year and I want to take care of my team and not add more stuff to their plate. You've got the straight A student. Nobody's going to be able to do it as well as me.
Yeah.
You've got the flash. Well, I can just do this in a jiffy. It's going to take me a lot less time to just slam it out than to tell someone else how to do it. You've got the whack-a-mole champ who loves to whack out everything and get it done and is responding to messages and teams and emails before the person who really should be. So yeah. You've got all these ways in which the sole provider gets activated. Mm. And one of the things I work with people on and the book talks about is how do you engage in ways that help disabuse you of those sole provider tendencies.
Yeah.
One of the first things you can do, and I love telling this to my clients, Dane, is shut up.
Yes.
Actually not be the first one to speak, not be the first one to respond to non-speaking things, you know, messages that come across. And the dual benefit of that is because in positions of power, nobody will tell you the full truth. When you stop speaking, you can sense, listen, observe a lot better too.
Yeah.
So you will get richer data about your team and where the team is, what the dynamics on the team are, what is the overall system, what are the overall pressures on the system when you shut up.
Yes.
So that's around pressure. Around power, one of the things you can do is move away from what's called the singular story. The more successful we are, the higher up we go. We've gotten there by being right a lot.
Mm.
And the problem is that sometimes then we very quickly jump to an assumption, a conclusion, and take action. And that action based on that singular story, while 9 times out of 10 might be correct, could also be incorrect, incomplete, or outdated.
Yeah.
Not to mention, again, stunting the growth and development and creativity of the team and the diversity of the ideas that can come out.
Yeah.
So again, in that case, how can you pause and make multiple meanings as opposed to a singular story and going forward with that?
Yeah. That one I love. I think I've had a number of guests come and talk about this, particularly the power dynamic of hierarchy, but also that some people's style is very much, you know, I like to enter an argument to win the argument, not to be curious. And then other people's style is, I like to sit back and not say what I think, going back to your volume knob that's broken, because I don't want to cause a stir.
Right.
And so often when you get a team together and a boss has that singular story, particularly if the boss is on that winning the argument side of the, yes, the behavioral spectrum,
yes. Yes.
Then the reality is the team already know it's not going to work, and yet they just kind of nod, smile, and walk out of the meeting going, oh, this is going to be painful.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
So that's super cool. Are there approaches that you favor in creating those multiple stories and accessing the, you know, the collective wisdom and mm-hmm. energy?
It's an approach that I taught my kids, and it's the same approach I favor for the executives I coach.
Yeah.
What happened was when my kids were young, one day I was on a walk and thinking, what is one of the biggest things my clients get into the most trouble with? These clients are in their 40s, 50s, 60s, and it was this singular story. And I thought, okay, I'm going to future-proof my kids against this. So I created a game called Multiple Meanings.
Oh, wow.
We, on the way to school, we would cross this bridge. And during the time we were on the bridge in our commute, one of us would pick something we noticed out there. And each of us would take turns making multiple meanings about it.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say we see a guy walking by. His arms are covered in tattoos. He's wearing a sleeveless leather vest.
Yes.
My older son, Zarif, might say, the tattoos are fresh. He needs something sleeveless for them to heal. I might say he's a lawyer by day job. This is his day off. He's showing off his tattoos. My younger son, Zivin, might say, let's see, there's a tattoo parlor on the other side of the bridge, and he's advertising that, and so on. So we built this muscle strength.
Yes.
And so the idea being, take something and start building that muscle, or if it's a work thing, don't solve. First, make 15 different meanings before you jump in to solve.
Yes.
Because what happened? What happened is, a month or two later, Zivin comes screaming, crying, Zarif's a rat, he stole my Lego piece. And I said, okay, maybe he's a rat, but can we play multiple meanings? And then he's like, maybe I had my headphones on, and he did ask, and so on. And so then he was able to unhook from his singular story, go ask Zarif, and the reality was Zarif noticed it under the dresser while he was tying his shoelaces.
Yeah.
Very different outcome than if you would have gone in with, you're a rat, you stole my Lego piece.
100%. And I've fallen foul of that so many times in
so
family and at work.
So many times. Yeah. Yes, it has actually improved my marriage by being able to make multiple meanings instead of going, why didn't you take the trash out on time? Oh, maybe because the trash company is on strike. Maybe it's the day after Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
There's so many other ways to interpret what's going on.
Yeah, I heard a great quote. I follow Ryan Holiday with the Daily Stoic. And he had a great quote that he shared out yesterday in some media that I was listening to. And it basically said, the one who can avoid attaching judgment and having an opinion about things can live a far happier and more effective life. Because I think it's not to say that you won't ultimately land a judgment or an opinion, but you don't just slap one on and have that singular story and move forwards with that belief. You stay more curious.
Yes. The way I would modify that statement
is
I would say, don't have a judgment, have multiple judgments.
I like that. Yeah.
Because, you know, as human beings, we are judging machines. We are storytelling, meaning-making machines. And I don't know that it's possible to completely detach from that without severing our brainstem.
Correct.
And so lean into it more. Make it a judo move where you're, okay, I'm not going to act until I have at least three very different judgments or stories.
Yes. It's interesting. I don't know if you've come across the Vistage, the CEO peer groups.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I was a part of one of those groups or a couple of those groups over the 7 or 8 year period. And one of the things that I loved that they had was this issue processing sheet. And when you're in a room with 15 CEOs, going back to your earlier point, you've got a lot of people that have been right and have been called upon to have quick instincts and decision-making capabilities. And so one CEO will bring an issue in their company or in their personal life to the group. And the discipline is very much your multiple story discipline. It's like, okay, before we start saying, I think you should do this, let's all ask questions. So we're going to go around the table and everyone's going to ask a question. Now, you're not making a different meaning of it yet, but by asking all of these questions and creating curiosity, it then shapes different meanings, different stories that may be happening. So maybe that CEO who shares that, you know, their top salesperson is toxic and is, you know, damaging the rest of the team, even though they're bringing in the best sales every year, it turns into something very different to, you know, actually you've got a compensation issue in your sales team, which is driving these behaviors.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yes. It transforms how you look at something.
Yeah.
And when you look at it differently, your solution becomes much richer.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And probably more accurate. And if you think about the amount of times in teams that we've all probably solved for the wrong problem and dragged the team through the pains of solving for the wrong problem, some of which can be irreversible. That's a lot of damage. All right. So this multiple meanings is how you approach the power gap, is that correct?
Yes. One of the ways.
Okay, neat. So basically, as you go through these different ways in the book of managing pressure and power, are you creating more of a chronological approach for a manager to address, you know, their career growth and becoming the boss, the leader they want to be? Or is it more, if you're in this scenario, here's a tool that might work? Is it more like a la carte menu?
It's more a la carte, but it's a very custom a la carte. And what I mean by that is towards the end of the book is a section called 360 Yourself.
Yes.
That is, assess yourself. There are 42 questions. They take about 10 to 12 minutes to do very quickly. Rate yourself toward these questions, geared toward each pressure pitfall and each power gap. So
yes.
Now you have a very quick back of the envelope diagnostic of which of these are you most likely to fall into.
That's neat. So now you've got a dashboard.
You've got a dashboard, exactly right. Pick the top or the lowest either scoring item on your dashboard. Simply go to that chapter.
Yeah.
You don't even have to read the book sequentially.
Oh, I like that. I like that a lot. So I'm kind of envisaging, I've got the dashboard, this light's flashing, and now I go to the owner's manual. I'm like, okay,
yeah, exactly.
Here's a question to ask or an activity to run.
Exactly.
That's great. That's really neat. And you said you had many pages of research to build the book. How much of this did you find from your own work coaching and leading the development of other leaders versus, you know, going out there into the world and exploring, you know, publicly available papers and research?
Right. Of course, I explored a lot of publicly available research and papers and leaned on the work of many of my colleagues. The 12,000 pages I referenced, Dane, came from my work, which is when I coach as CEO, I also interview about a dozen people around them. And I write down everything they say. So after thousands of interviews, I've got 12,000 pages of data.
Yeah.
And that is verbatim data of what people think of their bosses.
Very cool.
So
that's some great research.
Yes, exactly. It's real life people.
Yeah.
In real life jobs with their real life teams.
Yeah.
And so then analyzing that, both myself and having an objective third party analyze it, was helpful in surfacing these pressure pitfalls and power gaps.
That's neat. That's super neat. So when you look at that data and some of the methods that you built in the book, I know context matters. So if you're coaching a CEO in a white collar environment where the whole executive team is present in New York,
right,
or wherever it might be,
right,
or you're dealing with the CEO of a large manufacturing organization where a lot of their leaders are distributed through facilities all over the world.
You bet.
Where do you see some of those nuances start to pop up for leaders, you know, whether it's cross-cultural, geographic time zone boundaries? Mm-hmm. And do you sense that can peak the pressure pitfall or the power gaps in any way?
Well, this is a great question. You could even say, does gender make a difference? There's
true.
So many different
variables
and factors. It's, of course, not possible to compute for all of those factors. I was actually surprised, you know, when I say pressure corrupts and these behaviors that are less than healthy that show up under pressure for any of us and then in bosses, I was surprised to see that there was actually no gender difference.
Wow.
When I started analyzing men and women who are under tremendous amounts of pressure in equivalent jobs. So that was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
In general, I found that these pressure pitfalls and power gaps open up regardless of what type of job you have.
Yeah.
And because when I say CEO and that I coach CEOs, it's a very broad definition. It's not just CEOs of companies and in many sectors and different sizes. It's also a university president or the managing director of a research laboratory.
Yes.
So I found these common issues to show up whenever power and pressure collide.
Yes.
Will some of it show up more or less? Absolutely. Depending on various kinds of factors, geographical location, the culture of that geographical location.
Yes.
The upbringing of the person themselves, or the relationship to authority that culture has. There's just a myriad of ways to slice and dice it. So you're going to see ups and downs and variations that way. But the overarching themes have remained consistent throughout the people I interviewed.
Which is really neat because it means that you don't have to, you can follow a lot of the methods that you've got in the book. You don't have to be spending a whole lot of time saying, well, this will only work in a blue collar manufacturing environment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That's neat. So as you think about this shift, I know before the show we were saying that in the future we're moving from this like positional power to people power, and you talked about managers realizing that they don't have all of the answers now and they need to rely on the collective team. How do you think this is going to shift, or where do you see it may already be shifting our whole approach to building teams, developing team members? Is it going to change the landscape, you know, even from an early education standpoint in terms of how we create that muscle to be collective?
Yeah, I believe it will change it fundamentally.
Yep.
Now, what do we mean by that? Let's start with some data. There's a study that shows that CEOs are leaving their jobs in record numbers, higher than in the last 23 years.
Okay.
And the report in January said. And then it was followed up by another report that one of the reasons senior most executives are, there's an exodus, is because they're concerned that they're not the right people to lead organizations in the age of AI. They're not an AI first generation, just like perhaps CEOs several decades ago were not a digital first generation. And so it's not just first of all, I mean, it goes without saying, I think, that there are no easy answers right now in the times we live in. And there's a collision and of multiple complexities happening, not just one.
Yes.
Not just two, but multiple. And so who knows where everything is going to go? No one I mean, if someone says they have the answer, I would be very afraid. And that's not someone I would want to follow.
Yes.
They're realizing they, so there's that, but there's also this sort of mindset, this gestalt, and what you're talking about, like from, if you're not AI first, you're going to think very differently. So absolutely, we need to think about how we build those capacities right from the beginning to be more community focused as opposed to more expert focused.
Yes.
That the answer lies in the collective wisdom, the collective meaning making, talk about making multiple meanings before we even think about solutions to, and who knows how we're going to think about solutions for many of these very hairy challenges. The problem with this is that sometimes another pressure pitfall I talk about, our inner hungers get in the way. Our desire to be seen as the smartest person in the room, our desire to be seen as the hero or the savior, or to maintain our own corporate mortality, our corporate, I mean, a corporate longevity, those things show up. And so how can we get more conscious of what those are, those very human needs? And how can we not go to work hungry to feed those unsated desires? How can we get those needs met? So we're coming in with a full cup.
Yes.
Layer this with the complexity of systemic ways in which we reward people. We do not reward fire preventers. We reward firefighters, no matter what we say.
100%.
Exactly. So as long as we continue to reward the hero jumping from tall buildings, why am I going to give up protecting my own toward the greater good?
Yeah. That's so a really interesting one on the reward. Yeah.
Right.
I think there's a secondary factor there too, because I agree that incentives are real. But I actually think even outside of the explicit rewards of compensation, and even, you know, honors and you know, team awards, I think there's also this other reward, which is that some people just get fueled on the adrenaline and the cortisol of being the firefighter.
So true.
And it gives them meaning. It gives them mattering, even though it's fabricated and it's coming at a great cost to the team.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. I read somewhere that sometimes firefighters even are the arsonists.
Arsonists. I agree.
They miss the adrenaline and the rush.
Yeah. I can vouch for that personally, because after 20 something years of working in high highly charged and adrenaline-fueled environments. I took a period of time off this year for a new baby, and we sold one of our businesses. And I went from going 100 miles an hour to 0 miles an hour. My wife correctly accused me of going out and creating chaos and finding things to go and fix when I didn't have anything to do. She was like, can't you just sit there and hold the baby? Why do you have to go and fix that thing now? Like, what? It's been like that for the last 5 years. And it's fascinating the way our brain chemistry and structure
absolutely.
Works.
Absolutely. So first of all, congratulations on
Thank
your
you.
Baby.
Thank you.
And wow, what a huge shift.
Yeah.
What a huge shift. And this is one of the very practices I write about in the book called Blank Space, which is 2 hours a week of doing absolutely nothing.
Mm-hmm.
When under pressure, do nothing. Most of us under pressure want to do something.
Yeah.
It's that old saying of don't just do something, sit there.
Yes.
Right? It's
yes.
that reversal of that other saying. Yeah. That's what you need in times of high pressure, in terms of high uncertainty. Because whatever you're going to jump in and do, your instincts around how to solve problems in the old way are going to be dead wrong.
Particularly with AI, that's a brilliant call to action because you're right. Things are shifting so quickly. And if we are moving to the collective and the new, then it's actually the leader's job to get curious, not to jump in and fix it.
Yes.
Yeah. That's really interesting. It also that also ties in... Sabina, to some of the work I've been doing in therapy lately, building on a relationship challenge I had with my son, who's nearly 14, I realized that I was jumping in and fixing and getting through problems a lot and not taking enough time to really see him and understand his emotions. Mm-hmm. And so I was taking away that opportunity for him to recognize the emotions and do the work for himself. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of bosses fall into that too. Like right now, a lot of our employees, no matter what team you're on, they're going through a lot. We talked about it earlier, whether it's parenting, whether it's geopolitical, social drama, financial challenges. There's just a lot happening in life. And if we constantly keep jumping in to solve for, you know, Barry or Jenny turning up and being grumpy one day, and we try and solve it with an SOP rather than just, hey, maybe it's okay that Barry and Jenny were sad today or frustrated, and maybe we need to look after them as a human before we try and fix the work. There's something there.
There's absolutely something there. And I just think that we as a society are really not comfortable feeling things.
We're not.
We're That's human beings. We're not comfortable just being. We want to be human doings.
Yeah.
And we're also human feelings. And that part, we kind of get cut off the neck below the neck.
Yeah.
So, you know, as Brené Brown says, we have this foreboding joy. You know, whenever there's joy, we're like, oh, don't want to jinx it. When is something bad going to happen? But I don't think it's just joy. I think we try to timeline grief and sadness.
Yep.
We marginalize, minimize anger.
Mm-hmm.
So we reassure, jump in with reassurances, with fear. And again, it's human nature. Like, I would want to jump in and reassure my kids.
Yeah.
And of course, then they feel you're not seeing me.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's a really interesting one in that parenting dynamic, in the team dynamic. And I think it's fair to say, like, we've talked a lot about belonging in recent times, but I think my word for the year is mattering. And I think that's a big, important thing for team members, family members to be grappling with right now. And what we've talked about on a number of episodes is the difference between belonging and mattering is belonging is, hey, I'm accepted here. Mm-hmm. I might even be appreciated here. Mm-hmm. Whereas mattering is the work that I do, the role that I play is important to others. And I think that's an interesting shift that we're seeing in teams too.
Yes. That's so well said. Yeah.
Where do you see that in your work with when you're coaching leaders or in the book, that you're able to create more awareness of the importance of each member's work and not just the boss's work?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, you know, as I was talking about that sole provider, once you stop doing that, you're starting to see more. Once you engage your shut up muscle, you're engaging and activating everyone else. you're not stunting their growth, their development, their creativity as a result of it. You know, the other thing I say in the book is that as a manager, your job is not no longer to create the content. It's to create the container.
Yes.
It's to create the space in which people can learn, experiment, make mistakes, celebrate successes. It's the process. And then they get to do the hands-on work.
Yeah. I really like that, create the space, create the container. A good friend of mine, Dr. Andre Martin, and I were talking the other day about what a healthy team is. Mm-hmm. And as we looked at these various principles that we're kind of exploring through this podcast and other research, we identified that in a healthy team, the leader is a star maker, not a star themselves. Mm-hmm. And that's a big shift per your kind of guidance in a narrative in your book. It is a big shift. But if you create the space, like, you don't have to impart wisdom and knowledge on a team member like it once was in an apprenticeship model. Mm-hmm. You just need to let them go out and find their superpowers and their curiosities within that space.
Absolutely, yes. It's one of the seven communication fault lines I discuss. And it's called sage speak, where you're sitting on the top of a mountain being the sage as opposed to fellow pilgrims.
Yes, that's brilliant. I want more of the seven communication fault lines, because as soon as you said that, everything just lit up, because I've spoken to so many leaders lately who said, I'm doing these things really well, but communication is still the thing we struggle with most in our team. So tell me more about the fault lines.
Well, sage speak is one of them. Yeah. Another one is around the feedback flip and what that means. Again, this goes back to us thinking we have to do it all. Most managers find providing corrective feedback one of the most miserable parts of their job.
Yeah.
And many of them, including me when I was first starting out as a manager, have lost sleep and hair and all sorts of things.
Yeah.
In anticipation of those in anticipation of those difficult conversations.
Yeah.
And so why assume that the employee doesn't have any idea what feedback you're going to give them? That's where some of this anxiety is coming from. What if instead of first just barreling on and giving them the fire hose of feedback, what if you first checked in with them?
Yes.
Hey, how do you think that meeting went or that project went? What was your contribution to it? What could you have done better?
Yeah.
Many managers are afraid of doing that because they think, well, they're going to say they did fantastic and I think they sucked. Well, wouldn't you rather know if there's a disconnect up front?
Yeah.
Then you can be more proactive in framing your feedback. If that's the case, if there is a disconnect, you might say, wow, maybe this is just a perception issue, which is good news.
Yeah.
Still an issue, but my perception is very different from yours. Let me share that.
Yes.
More often, what managers find is there isn't that much of a perception gap, and they can have a much more productive, collegial conversation on, okay, how do I support you? What do you need to do? This doesn't mean I'm letting them off the hook. I'm just starting with them.
Yes.
So that's the feedback flip, is start with them instead of you giving them the feedback.
I'm going to put that into use next week because I'm
fabulous.
Forever.
Let me know how it goes.
Yeah, I will. I'm forever chasing better ways to do feedback.
Yeah.
That's a cool one. And any of the others that you think stand out that are worth touching on, Sabina?
Well, another one around feedback. Couples research shows that for a partner to believe that they're getting one-to-one, 50-50 positive and negative stuff from their partner.
Yeah.
The partner has to provide 5 positives for every 1 negative.
Really?
Really.
That explains so much. Wow.
I told you writing this book was good for my
marriage. Yeah, I mean, rightfully so. I see it go both ways. You know, my wife might say 1 or 2 cutting comments to me in a day, and I feel like I'm wearing it, and vice versa. But 5 to 1, that's...
5 to 1.
That's huge.
And so my guess is that human beings are human beings, and that probably translates to work as well.
Yeah, I think it can only translate to work.
Yes, yes. So that's the uneven feedback communication fault line.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. All right. So no more 50-50.
No more 50-50.
Yeah.
Even if you did actually, in reality, even if you did 50-50, you'd be better.
Yes.
Because most of us are doing probably 20-80.
Yes.
At best.
Yeah. The proverbial.
So that's where you need to start. Start there.
That's right. The proverbial sandwich needs to become like a club sandwich.
Oh, then. Gosh. Yeah. I totally don't believe in the sandwich.
No. No, that's it. All right. That's very cool. All right. Well, there's so many different reasons that I need to grab a hold of the book now, because I love just the pragmatic, you know, deploy ready nature of some of these approaches that you're sharing.
Thank you.
What, when you've worked with some of these leaders to put some of these practices into place, what have you found to be the time to impact? Like, are you seeing very quick changes in these leaders and their teams? And how does that flow down?
Some of them are immediate.
Yeah.
And usually within the next 3 months.
That's quick.
For example, the shut up muscle, right?
Yes.
You go to the next meeting and you're the fourth person to speak.
Yeah.
Now, initially, people are going to go, what's wrong? Why aren't they speaking? Am I getting fired? You know, they'll make up all those stories.
Yeah.
You can be transparent about it. And then they go, this is just flavor of the day. Okay, so in a week, 2 weeks, it'll shift. As long as you have the discipline to stick with it.
Yes.
So there are many things like that where you can apply them immediately at very low cost. This is not going to require extra time for you.
Yeah.
For example, I have a micro habit for every one of the pressure pitfalls and power gaps. A micro habit is something that is so small that you're going to laugh out loud at how ridiculously small it is.
Okay.
And that's why you'll do it. So for example, if your goal is to be more physically fit.
Yes.
It's not about going to the gym every day at all. It's about doing one push-up.
Ah, interesting.
One push-up.
Yeah.
Now, who's going to say, that's not going to happen?
Yeah.
Or whatever exercise.
You start.
That you prefer. You start really low and you remain really low for a really long time until that becomes such an unconscious habit that only then do you increase it in size.
Yes.
So if you do any of these tools, you apply any of them in a micro fashion, that is an immediate application with really no extra time and of immediate benefit.
Yeah. I really like that approach too. Yeah, I've found going to that shut up muscle, and it is a bit of a micro habit of sorts. What we do now in our rugby club, which I've learned from some of the older age group coaches, is when the team come off at halftime, most coaches will walk in and be like, sit down, okay, this didn't go right, that didn't go right, you did good here, let's do this next, right?
Yeah.
Just bang, bang, bang. And these guys are just coming off tired. Our micro habit now is doing three process breaths. So we give it to the captain to do and we go, okay, let's all circle up. And then they lead off three ins and three outs. Nice. On the breathing. And just that habit of doing the breathing and not talking for a minute, it's the shut up muscle. But then the next thing is you ask a question to the captain. Hey, what went well out there, or what didn't go so well out there, or what were you surprised by?
Lovely. And yeah, that's the feedback flip.
It's great. Yeah, there you go. So I accidentally ran into it, but you're creating the intentionality.
Beautiful, beautiful. This reminds me that one of my micro habits, I like to say I have a daily meditation practice.
Yeah.
You know how long my daily meditation practice is?
No.
The first thing I do when I wake up, one inhale and one exhale. That's my daily meditation
practice. Brilliant. Yeah. That's all it needs to be. Because so many people are doing the life hack where they're like waking up, sauna, meditation, read a book, journal, and they're 3.5 hours in and it's overkill.
Yeah. It's whether or not it's overkill, I'd love to do that every morning.
Yeah.
It's just not going to happen. It's not realistic for most of our lives.
Yeah. Or if it does happen, it's happening at a cost of something else.
Right.
A family member or a team member not getting access to you or,
exactly.
or whatever it might be. That's really interesting. No, that's super cool. Well, it's been a wonderful, wonderful conversation, Sabina. I'm super excited to read You're the Boss. Sounds like a great book with some really cool insights from all of your thousands of 360-degree interviews. If any of our listeners want to go out there and find the book, how do they best, or you, how do they best connect?
The book is available anywhere books are available. They can come to my website, sabinanawaz.com.
Yeah.
Once you buy the book, you can download many of those tools so you can try them all out firsthand.
Brilliant.
Without having to write in the book or figure out how to do it, you'll have a step-by-step guide that's free to you. You can also sign up there or on Substack directly for my newsletter, which is called Pressure Proof.
Pressure Proof. I love that. And I really do like this pressure corrupts and power isolates you from the impact, because that's a very, it's a very clean and neat visualization for any of us as leaders to just be checking in on ourselves. And I appreciate the way that you've shared that. And particularly, again, I'm a very visual person. I like how you explained that the power causes you to be dealing with the broken volume knob when it comes from feedback coming up. So I don't think there's a leader out there, or a team member for that matter, that can't associate with that phenomenon. Yeah. Well, thanks for your time. I hope you have a wonderful continuation of launching the book, and I look forward to collaborating soon.
Thank you so much. And for the listeners, I love collaboration. If you use any of these tools and you find it useful, or you tweak it for your own practical purposes, let me know through my website, because that then benefits all my readers.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, Sabina. And I'm sure we'll be circling back to dive into some of those findings and feedbacks too.
Thank you, Dane.
Thank you for joining us. Remember that by embracing vulnerability, trusting our intuition, and approaching challenges with compassion, we not only strengthen our teams, but also pave the way for a future where collaboration thrives. If you're hungry for more insights, strategies, and research on collaboration, head over to thefutureofteamwork.com. There, you can join our mailing list to stay updated with the latest episodes and get access to exclusive content tailored to make your team thrive. Together, we can build the future of teamwork. Until next time,